From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas says he's rejecting further U.S. mediation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict following President Trump's decision last month to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Speaking to the Palestinian Central Council in Ramallah, Mr. Abbas said political negotiations should be under international mediation. He added, "We do not accept America as mediator between us and Israel." American University Professor Emeritus of the Center for Israel Studies, Russell Stone, says it is really an expression of frustration.
Trump's declaration on December 6th was unilateral and done without consultation. And it's taken over a month for the Palestine National Council to develop any kind of formal reaction to it. There's been a lot of informal reaction in the form of demonstrations, but it's really just a protest.
Israeli-Palestinian peace talks have been frozen since April of 2014. President Trump last year expressed hope a peace deal could be reached, calling the deal of the century. Mr. Abbas said the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital was, in his words, actually the slap of the century. Hundreds of people took to the streets of Tunisia's capital for a new demonstration, and in one district, police fired tear gas, dispersing dozens of stone-throwing youths on the 7th anniversary of the ousting of former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Fueled by rising frustrations with the country's social and economic issues, protesters have been demonstrating constantly. This is VOA News. Delegations from two Koreas are meeting today to hammer out details about the North sending a troop of artistic performers to next month's Winter Olympics in the South. North Korea's recent conciliatory moves are widely viewed as an attempt to ease tensions after last year's nuclear and ballistic missile test. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson joins foreign ministers in Vancouver, Canada tomorrow to assess further diplomatic options to counter Pyongyang's security threat. Officials say Washington is not advocating for regime change in North Korea, but the U.S. is talking to China about what to do with the North's nuclear weapons to prepare for any scenario. Steve Goldstein is a U.S. State Department undersecretary.
So our suggestion is that the Chinese military officials meet with our military officials so that we can come up with a plan to dispose of those nuclear weapons in a manner that's safe for all countries and all people involved.
Analysts say China is handling the sensitive issue with great caution. While China and Russia are not invited to the Vancouver meeting, U.S. officials say they will receive a readout of Tuesday's talks. Officials continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding the Saturday incident in which residents of the westernmost U.S. state and the Central Pacific, Hawaii, were erroneously sent emergency alerts warning of an incoming missile. Tulsi Gabbard is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Hawaii.
You can only imagine the panic, the terror, the chaos and confusion that ensued when over a million people in Hawaii, plus many visitors who were visiting Hawaii, got that alert on their cell phones, now understanding that they literally just have minutes, taking this threat seriously. They've got minutes to say goodbye to their loved ones, to find their loved ones, to try to find some kind of shelter somewhere, which there are no designated nuclear bomb shelters in Hawaii.
Hawaii Governor David Ige said the false missile alert that panicked islanders Saturday was totally unacceptable and told reporters he's angry, disappointed by the situation, that they're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. Afghan government negotiators and Taliban officials have reportedly opened unofficial talks in Turkey to discuss mechanisms that could pave the ground for initiating a formal peace dialogue. Meetings in Turkey come as the UN Security Council delegation is in Kabul holding talks with Afghan leaders on security and political issues. Visit comes as security around Afghanistan has deteriorated, with government forces and Taliban insurgents engaged in staging battlefield operations and guerrilla attacks. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, the 15th day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's ruling Unity Party explains why it expelled President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and three other officials.
If you cannot campaign for your own party and you went out to campaign for other political parties, it makes the violation of the party's constitution very gross, and that warranted at the least expulsion from the party.
Mohamed Ali is the national spokesman for the ruling Unity Party of Liberia. The Liberian legislature returns to work today from its holiday break with leadership elections high on the agenda. South Sudan denies violating the cessation of hostilities agreement, and Zambia relaxes rules put in place to fight a cholera epidemic.
We have seen numbers plummet from a daily caseload of around 164 7 days ago to under 70. We've also seen that we've implemented interventions to scale.
Dr. Chitalu Chilufwa is Zambia's health minister, and another fuel crisis hits Burundi's capital. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It appears Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who leaves office a week from today, Monday, will be doing so without a political party. This after the National Executive Committee of the ruling Unity Party over the weekend expelled the president and three other party officials. Party spokesman Mohamed Ali says President Sirleaf and three officials committed violations of the party's constitution and engaged in acts inimical to the existence and reputation of the party, including not supporting the party's candidate in the just concluded presidential election.
The party's constitution in Article 7, Section 1E, clearly states that partisans are under obligation to support and campaign for party's candidates in elections. And these four individuals clearly campaign against our presidential and vice presidential candidates in the just in the 2017 elections. And so those were gross violations of the party's constitution.
What does the Unity Party at this current time hope to achieve or benefit from by expelling the president?
The point there is, first, we have to set the record straight. Second, we have to abide by the rules and regulations that govern the institution. We cannot have an institution in which members consistently violate the party's constitution, they violate the rules and regulations, and you take no action against them. That will not send a good signal to the Liberian people.
The fact that the president or Senator Kamene Wissah or the others did not campaign for the vice president during the just concluded runoff election, that was public knowledge. Why did the party not act then? Why are you acting now?
Well, because the election ended, so we have to gather a few reports from the various committees. We have to gather reports from the campaign committee. And once those reports were made, the resolutions from the counties were made, that these were the observations, that these are key former officials and current officials. Not only that they didn't campaign for the party, but they were also seen campaigning for opposition party. And if you cannot campaign for your own party and you went out to campaign for other political parties and supported other political institutions, it makes the violation of the party's constitution very gross, and that warranted at the least expulsion from the party.
This is leaving some people to believe that perhaps this expulsion is just done to embarrass the president.
No, we don't do expulsion to embarrass anyone. So when a resolution is submitted to the executive committee to expel an individual, investigation has to be done and the evidences adduced before the National Executive Committee has to be convincing for you to take that action, because it's not an easy thing to expel a member, particularly so when you're talking about the president.
Mohammed Ali is the national spokesman for Liberia's ruling Unity Party. He's speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A spokesman for President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said the president and the three other officials will likely respond sometime this week following consultations. The 54th session of the Liberian legislature opens today, Monday. Top on the agenda is the election of a new Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President Pro Temp of the Senate. As T.T. Jibril reports from Monrovia, one of the major contenders for the speakership has announced he's pulling out of the race.
Hans Bashu, who was contesting as an independent candidate from a bloc known as the Reform Bloc, expressed disappointment in representatives from the Unity Party for not remaining in opposition, told the incoming ruling Coalition for Democratic Change, led by President-elect George Weah, as the CDC date for 12 years.
Instead of having one relationship with George Weah, not even taking office, the Unity Party has decided to join the CDC, thereby denying all those who voted for her the privilege to be heard through their representation. So because the CDC at this time, but they should be the leading opposition party, in my mind, shows some level of deception and must be guarded with caution.
The Coalition for Democratic Change and the outgoing Unity Party have a combined with 42 out of the 66 cleared and certificated representatives who are expected to vote in today's election. The 42 representatives signed a resolution days ago to support Bofal Chambers from the CDC as Speaker and Prince Moyi of the UP as Deputy Speaker. But despite Bashu's characterization of the Unity Party action as an act of dishonesty, UP spokesman Moali said their action was only done in the interest of the people.
We are not doing this because we love CDC. We're doing this because we love Liberia and because we don't want the House of Representatives to be plagued with instability in the leadership. We want them to concentrate on doing the work for their people.
Representative Bashu, a day to today's election, said he decided to contest for the speakership to correct the excesses and bring about reform and independence to the legislature. But he said the action of the Unity Party has left him with no option but to step aside.
If the leading opposition party decides to support Madam Weah and whoever are, and Bashu, I will also support Madam Weah. I will not be contesting.
Meanwhile, the Liberian Senate has decided to rally around Senator Albert Chai, a native of President-elect George Weah's Grand Cru County, though Lofa County Senator Steve Zago decided to contest, stressing regional balance of power. But in a late Sunday final meeting at a local hotel in the capital, Senator Zago was awarded a compromised deal to forego his ambition to be pro tem and replace President-elect Weah as chair of the Senate's committee to the ECOWAS Parliament, paving the way for Senator Chai to the pro tem position on a white ballot. Political pundits believe there will be little checks and balances on the incoming CDC-led government as a result of recent political maneuverings. For VOA Daybreak Africa, I'm Titi Jibro, reporting from Monrovia, Liberia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, January 15th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The Zambian government over the weekend eased regulations it imposed to combat a cholera epidemic that has gripped the country since October last year, leading to the death of 74 people, a majority of them in the capital, Lusaka. Health Minister Chitalu Chilufwa says the number of new cases have declined dramatically in the past week from around 164 per day to under 70. As a result, the minister says international schools will be allowed to reopen on the 16th of January, while public schools will reopen on January 22nd.
We have seen numbers plummet from a daily caseload of around 164 7 days ago to under 70. Secondly, we've also seen that we've implemented interventions to scale, addressing the drivers of the epidemic, which by and large were consumption of contaminated water from shallow wells in unplanned settlements. We have seen that there's been an overwhelming response to the vaccination campaign. We've already hit over 72% on average in all the epicenters. The trading places have been inspected, decontaminated. Our waste disposal mechanisms have been improved, and we've cleared the solid waste that was lying in drainages.
We know that perhaps schools were supposed to open on January 22nd. Could you explain when you say the schools are going to reopen early or later? What's the exact date and which schools are opening?
The calendar, we have schools in two categories. We have international schools that have their calendars aligned to the international calendars in various countries. And we also have public and private schools that have calendars aligned to our government, school calendar. So those that are aligned to the international calendar were due to open on the 16th of January. And we have allowed them, they're going to proceed. And we have not delayed them in reopening. Government schools were supposed to reopen on 14th of January. We have said they can now reopen on 22nd. So government schools and private schools that use the government calendar in Zambia have lost 1 week. And this has given us time to ensure that sanitation facilities and the water infrastructure in these schools are good.
What about other gatherings, like church gatherings, maybe funerals?
Yes. At the peak of the epidemic, I issued the statutory instrument number 79, which introduced the ban on public gatherings in the epicenters and in high-risk areas. In the non-epicenters, we restricted operating hours for bars.
Do you feel pressure to reopen some of these places because of economic concerns? Because I was reading somewhere where it says that in the Lusaka district alone, there were 87 new cases reported. So why are you taking these measures to relax instead of keeping it up until everything is fine? Are you under pressure economically?
Not at all. I must emphasize, Lusaka has recorded a total of 3,060 cases of cholera. Out of these, we have successfully treated 2,992 and discharged them. We've lost 68 cases, and these, by and large, have been community deaths.
Dr. Chidalu Chilufya is Zambia's health minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Burundi has again been hit by another fuel shortage, with business owners calling on the government to find a quick solution so as to avoid price increases. As Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, this is perhaps the fourth fuel crisis to hit the country since May last year.
This is not the first time Burundi is experiencing a fuel shortage countrywide. There were four instances of fuel shortage in 2017. There are long queues of cars in the capital waiting to be refueled. Daniel Mitabakana, the director in charge of petroleum in Burundi Ministry of Energy and Mines, says that the shortage will be solved soon.
For PNM, it's not enough, but we are doing all that can be possible so that the problem may find a solution in the just in coming, in a few coming days. You know, during the beginning of the year, there are some programs to prepare how to begin the year. They have some payments which must be done. So that is a problem, but it will be solved the next day.
Fuel station owners and managers stayed away from commenting on the ongoing fuel shortage, but some have linked the crisis to the lack of foreign reserves in the central bank for the importers to import fuel in the country. Zoisaba Alexandre is a trader who imports goods from neighboring Tanzania.
When there is a fuel scarcity, this affects businesses. On different sides, for example, when these carriers, when they go to bring goods, you know, when they don't get the fuel at the official price, they go to the black market. And when they buy the fuel at high price, these affect our goods on the market. So the prices become high.
People are buying fuel at a black market prices, which doubles the actual price of the gallon of fuel. Abdikarim is one of the mechanicians in Burundi and frequently uses generator for welding. He says that he asked the Burundi government to resolve the fuel crisis in the country and that most of the businesses risks to be affected by the shortage. Karim says that the fuel shortage in the country is a precedent from the last year and that the government should stabilize the supply of fuel in the country. Though the government said that the fuel crisis in the country is due to technical issues related to the start of the new year, analysts and some investors in the country said that the current fuel shortage was due to lack of foreign reserves in the central bank. The European Union and the United States suspended direct aid to the Burundi government in 2015, citing human rights violations by some government officials since 2015. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
South Sudan has again said its forces are not violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. In a joint statement issued last Friday, African Union Chairman Moussa Faki Mahamat and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres both condemned recent violations of the agreement. The tricat countries of Norway, Britain, and the United States also condemned the violations and called on all fighting South Sudanese parties to cease hostilities. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay says government forces have not violated the cessation of hostilities agreement. He says those claiming violation should have been specific about those who are violating the agreement.
This idea of the parties are in violation is no longer acceptable. The authors of the press release should have made it clear whether it is the South Sudan government or it is the estranged groups. Other parties who are signatory to the agreement who are in violation. This idea of making a sweeping statement holding the parties responsible for a violation is not correct, it is inaccurate, it is not in place. It is high time for whoever issues any press release to put it in clear words. The agreement has set up a mechanism for the monitoring and evaluation. It has set up the CITESAM. That is the body that will to whom we will report any violations, and they are the ones to come out with the report. But when people hastily decide to come up with statements that are not healthy, this is not acceptable. I thought the correct mechanism should have been to contact the. We have already reported all these violations to the CITESAM, and the CITESAM that will come out with its final report. This is the report on which you can condemn whoever is found to have violated, but not to continue issuing statements that are of general nature, statements that do not serve any interest.
But, Mr. Minister, this statement called on all fighting forces in South Sudan.
I said South Sudan has never violated the cessation of hostilities. It is the rebels who have ever been violating, and we have been reporting this to the CITESAM, which is the body authorized to verify whatever violation reported.
I think that statement, the Troika and the African Union statement, also blamed one of the attacks on the former chief of defense, Paul Malon, and his forces. Now, does your government have an audio tape of General Malon ordering attacks?
General Malon, when did he issue his audio tape for ordering the attack? Is it when he was already removed or when he was the chief of general staff?
Let me repeat again, Minister. Does your government have an audio tape of General Malon ordering attacks?
These are issues we cannot talk about. We cannot talk of issues that are not substantiated. Whether he has or not, if there is any violation, we will report the violation, not the audio report.
I have an article here that said the presidential spokesman, Attain, has questioned the logic behind the denial of the authenticity of the audio tapes. If he questioned the authenticity, that means you know that is true.
I said that is the press secretary of the office of the president.
Is your government holding prisoners of war?
The government does not have any prisoners of war at present. Yes, in the past, the government had prisoners of war, but they were all released by His Excellency the President when he launched the national dialogue that he issued an order for the release of all the prisoners of war. and all these prisoners of war were released and handed over.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the 2018 CAF Organized African Nations Championship, where host Morocco got their 2018 CHAN campaign off to a winning start as they defeated Mauritania 4-0 in the opening Group A match in Casablanca on Saturday night. Sudan edged out Guinea 2-1 on Sunday. The victory takes the Falcons of Gideon to second spot on the group standings, while the National Elephants are placed third on the table. In Group B, Debuton, Namibia stunned Ivory Coast 1-0, while Zambia thrashed Uganda 3-1. Action shifts to Group C later today as Libya squares out against Equatorial Guinea, while Nigeria will meet Rwanda in the late kickoff. The Ivorian Football Federation has sacked its vice president, Malik Tohe. Malik Tohe is under investigation for misconduct, and the FIF has issued a statement regarding the future of the vice president to Sidi Diallo. In a statement, the Federation's executive committee said it fired him from his position in accordance with Article 47 of the FIF. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has congratulated striker Michael Olunga for scoring in the Spanish La Liga after the Harambee Star striker netted a hat-trick for Girona FC in their 6-0 thrashing of Las Palmas on Saturday. The 23-year-old Olunga, who is on loan from Chinese club Guizhou Hengfeng, also became the first Kenyan to score in the Spanish La Liga. In women's football news, Nigeria under 20 women football team, the Falconers, defeated their South African counterpart, Bessena, 2-0 at the weekend to edge closer to securing a place at the 2018 FIFA under 20 Women's World Cup in France. First half strikes from Rashidat Ajibade and Annam Imo gave the Falconers a huge first leg advantage ahead of their reverse fixture in Benin City in the fortnight. In cricket news, Kenya opened their return to the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup on a losing note when they went down by 169 runs to 2014 champions South Africa at the Lincoln Green Christchurch, New Zealand on Sunday. And finally, in boxing news, Nigerian-born British boxer Anthony Joshua will put his perfect 20-fight, 20-knockout record on the line when he takes on New Zealand's Joseph Parker in a World Heavyweight Unification bout in Cardiff, Wales on March the 31st. Anthony Joshua holds the WBA and IBF versions of a crown, while Parker is the WBO champion and unbeaten in 24 contests with 18 knockouts. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. It appears Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who leaves office a week from today, Monday, will be doing so without a political party. This after the National Executive Committee of the ruling Unity Party over the weekend expelled the president and three other party officials. Party spokesman Mohammed Ali says President Sirleaf and the three officials violated the party's constitution and engaged in acts inimical to the existence and reputation of the party. And that's it for this Monday, January 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective.
We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.